godly play, when you present the children with a parable, it always comes in a gold box. We remind them that it's gold because parables are precious, and that it looks like a gift because it is a present for you, and that it looks old because parables are from very long ago, and it has a lid because sometimes it can be hard to get inside. So in the classroom, we have a row of gold parable boxes that all look alike. They don't have the name of the parable written on them. If you look closely, though, you'll find a small colored dot that will be a hint as to what parable might be inside the box. This makes sense, of course, if you think that we may have some preschoolers in the classroom who may not be able to read a label yet. But I found out that it is done this way for even more profound reasons. The thinking behind that is that when we name a parable, we reduce its meaning immediately to one point of view. The parable in the box with the gold dot might have any number of names and any number of main characters. It might be the parable of the mustard seed. It might be the parable of the farmer who planted mustard, or of the birds who like to make nests in the mustard bushes. Each of these is a valid way to look at it, and children don't always agree with adults as to who the central point might be. I remember as a child asking my parents to read me the book about the stars in the storm, much to their puzzlement. I meant the book of Genesis and the creation story, where our illustrated Bible had clouds of swirling galaxies painted across the sky. I wanted the book and the stars in the storm. Children fix their attention on different elements and they surprise us. We adults, however, want our names and our labels, our chapter headings, and the moral of the story is this. We have the parable of the mustard seed and of the Good Samaritan, the parable of the prodigal son, and hearing these names, you know already who the main character is, and maybe even what the moral of the story might be. But we lose so much when we label them. Some of us, of course, have been mislabeled ourselves. Some grew up in families where children were labeled the smart one versus the athletic one, perhaps the sensitive one, perhaps the walking disaster. Even if the name was never spoken out loud in our presence, we knew and we probably resented it. With or without a label, though, today's parable is not one that we would share with children. It is frankly too difficult. One commentary said that it begs to be misinterpreted. And it is also too violent, what with all that weeping and gnashing of teeth in the outer darkness. If I were allowed to remove a few passages from the Bible, this might be on the candidates for the chopping block. But we would do well to take some time wondering about it in a godly play style. Trying to enter the mind of the different characters will leave us in different directions as we look for a helpful interpretation. First, we can use the most common title, the parable of the talents. A talents, as we noticed, is a large sum of money. This is the original meaning of the word talent. In dictionaries of antiquity, it would keep company with obscure words like denarius and mina and shekel. But the word talent escaped that vocabulary and entered common usage because of this parable. A metaphorical use was created to deal with the fact that most of us have never been given an exorbitant amount of money to invest, but we would like to relate to this parable. So each time you hear anybody talking about any other kind of talent, whether musical or artistic or administrative, what you are hearing is the echoes of several centuries of sermons. Preacher after preacher after preacher has waxed eloquent about how this parable is about you, regardless of whether or not you have a large pile of silver coins hanging around. It doesn't matter how much you are given, whether your gifts are large or small, as long as you use what God has given you to its fullest. Anything you have might be a talent in disguise, waiting for you to invest it and increase it. This is a true and good message. Most of all, I am impressed at the way that centuries of preaching have totally changed the way this word is used. But our story might not be the parable of the talents. That might be the wrong name for it. Perhaps it's about something different. We could try out the second most common title for this parable, the parable of the harsh master. He is harsh indeed and does not apologize even a little bit as he roughly assesses the slave's abilities and challenges them and demands a high return and uses threats and punishments liberally. But thinking about this story in this way should hopefully make you start questioning whether the master would in fact be representing God in that capacity. Perhaps instead it is the parable of the unspoken expectations. The moral of the story being good enough is never good enough. The trust is a burden. Only outstanding success will be accepted. Try harder. Or for a more psychological interpretation, it could be the parable of the self-fulfilling prophecy. The first two slaves, feel the master trusts them. They feel confident, and so they do well, and so they are rewarded. The last slave does not trust him. He has no confidence, and so he does poorly, and so he is punished. The master treats them as they expect to be treated. There is a lot of truth in that possible interpretation. For one, it sounds like real life. Some of us are so afraid of doing wrong that we end up doing nothing instead. But again, it's hard to find a way to compare that master to God. When we try to interpret parables, we usually try to locate two main characters, which is the one who stands for us and which is the one who stands for God. It's quite obvious that we ought to take ourselves as slaves and God as the master, especially since the same word for master means Lord and is used of God and of Jesus. But at the same time, we ought to be at least a little bit outraged when we hear the master in this parable say, in effect, the rich will get richer and the poor will get poorer, as if this were the divine intention. We know that is not the message Jesus preached. I will never forget what it was like to lead a Bible study with teenagers in Uganda who came across the line, "Blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven," and asked incredulously, "Is Jesus telling us we should be poor?" It suddenly seemed like a joke, a trick question, and rightly so. I hadn't realized how wonderfully absurd it was for Jesus to say, "Blessed are the poor," until I heard it questioned by people who live in real poverty. Before that moment, I had always seen the verse with what I like to call my stained glass blinders. It was spoken in church language, surrounded by beautiful spiritual thoughts, accompanied by organ and four-part choir, always solemnly and reverently, but usually irrelevant to my life. But when this Ugandan teenager confronted the verse, the decorations suddenly fell away, and I saw the message of that verse in its sharp and clear confrontation. When today's parable is told as the parable of the talents, I think it's told with stained glass blinders on. We see it sentimentally and uncritically, and we don't get surprised. If you ever find yourself reading the Bible with stained glass blinders on, you may be suffering from privilege. Because the Bible is meant to be read from the margins. And when we read it from too comfortable a place, we miss much of its meaning. Now, there are a few sections of the Bible that are meant to be read above. from positions of power. For example, the Psalms that are supposed to be written by or about King David are definitely pro-monarchy. And many epistles, such as the Peters and the Timothys, were written pseudonymously in order to bolster the power of leaders in the church and silence their dissenters. For more on that topic, I can lend you a copy of my master's thesis. Those few books aside, much of the Bible is written by and for people in exile or under occupation, small ethnic minorities being actively persecuted. If we want to relate to those stories, we need to see it from their point of view because our lives are too distant. It's like the difference between me living in a city in air-conditioned comfort and you living on the banks of a river that floods regularly. We might read the same articles about climate change, but we experience it so differently. One of my favorite bloggers, Rachel Held Evans, got into a rant on Facebook this week about theologians. She pointed out that most of us assume privilege is normal, and that experiencing oppression is an exception from the norm. Therefore, women, people of color, indigenous ethnicities, uneducated people, or anybody else different have to hear their perspective summarized as contextual theology, as if privilege itself were not a context. And I quote from Rachel Held Evans, "The problem is, this is not how Jesus did theology. Jesus did theology among the outliers, the poor, the sick, the marginalized, women, Samaritans, fishermen, and he was rejected by the religious elite. I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, Jesus proclaimed, because you have hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to little children." Theology is for everyone. And if theology doesn't make sense among the very people Jesus centered his ministry around, then it doesn't make sense. If it's not good news for the poor, it's not good news. If it's not good news for the hungry, it's not good news. If it's not good news for the oppressed, the forgotten, the hurting, the lonely, the people who hunger and thirst for righteousness, the spiritually and physically sick, then it's not good news. And my theology is only as rich as the diversity of people who have contributed to it. And it is a poor theology indeed that considers only the perspectives of those who look, think, and live just like me. End quote. We need to do theology and live our faith in the company of others, and especially those with whom Jesus spent his time, or else it may be empty. This rule becomes especially important when we read difficult passages like this parable, and also the second passage that Art read from Thessalonians, where the central theme is the day of the Lord, an ultimate reckoning, an end of things as we know them, the reward of the just, and the weeping and gnashing of teeth for those hypocrites. It is a significant theme in Hebrew scriptures and even more prominent in the early Christian writings, where they expected Jesus to return in power within their lifetimes and bring all things to a dramatic conclusion. So, for us, it is all too easy to slap a label on these texts. They are apocalyptic, set them aside together, or even put them on the chopping block and take them out of the Bible if we could, because we may know, in the comfort of our science and technology, that the world itself is in little danger of actually ending soon. But if we were to set aside these texts about a final judgment, we would be forgetting that there are people for whom the end of the world is constantly at hand. People who live daily in the desperate marginal land between life and death, who do not have the privilege of education, technology, or money to insulate them from the very hard reality of this world and the way it works. From the one who has nothing, even what he has will be taken away, and it is so. To such as these, much of the Bible speaks directly, promising a great reckoning where God will judge us fairly and where our suffering will no longer be in vain. Even if we are waiting for millennia, it is never too long to wait for that promise. Jesus tells another parable of a master who left on a journey. This time he doesn't have money to entrust, but he entrusts the care of many slaves to a manager and goes away. The manager thinks the master will probably be gone a long time, and he begins to get drunk and beat the slaves. But the master comes back early and catches him at it. The master rescues the slaves and casts the manager out to that same darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Where might you find yourself in that story? Would you be the manager and hope that you would do a better job than this one? Or do you identify with the slaves, desperately longing for the return of the master and the day of vindication? If we read with people who are too comfortable, we only see one character. We only see one side of the story. If we have the stained glass blinders of privilege on, we need to read and discuss these stories with those who do not, especially with the poor, the excluded, and the little children. I'd like to finish with a different retelling of the same parable, one which turns it on its head and mercifully stops us from thinking that the master would be representing God. We see it instead as a reality tale. It tells what life is like in an unfair economy where the rich do get richer and the poor do get poorer. This is the parable of the resistant slave. The boss hands out money for investment and goes away. Two slaves engage in various cutthroat and speculative investment practices while the boss is gone. How else would you double your money so quickly? The ends justify the means, after all, and their ends are to be praised and rewarded by their master, who nonetheless keeps all the money. The one slave who refuses to play the boss's game, who opts out by burying the money for safekeeping, is punished because he refuses to be exploited. He's fired. He must make the rest of his life as a peasant or a beggar. Maybe the talents are not our God-given gifts. Maybe they are the financial tasks given to us by the bosses of society who demand we produce more, buy more, squeeze more, and spend more on the hamster wheel of success. Maybe this slave was the only wise one in the story. And maybe if we put ourselves in it, maybe we are more like the masters. I did not think of this interpretation by myself, and I wouldn't even have found it if I hadn't taken my stained glass blinders off long enough to read articles coming from the margins and join the people out there who cry out loudly, "God is not an extortionist." In this story, God might not be in the master, but in the slave. And it is there that we find Christ. I hope that you have heard something to inspire or challenge you today. I hope that the next time you open a Bible, you might read it without those stained glass blinders, disregarding the chapter headings, but considering how it speaks to the least of these, the poorest of the poor. But most of all, I hope and pray that we will all meet and greet and love and listen to the words of God, which are spoken from the margins by the poor, the oppressed, and the little children. May our eyes and ears, our hearts and our minds be open to meet God in the world today. Amen.